I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, all kinds of folks made their debut on Twitter this year, including His Holiness Pope Benedict XVI. We decided we wanted to talk about the best and worst of 2012 on Twitter. That's coming up later in the program. But first, it's time for our weekly visit to the barber shop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for the last shape-up of 2012 is writer and culture critic Jimmy Israel. He's with us from Cleveland. Pablo Torre is a senior writer with ESPN.com. He's in our bureau in New York. In our Washington, D.C. studios, we have civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar and R. Clark Cooper. He is the executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans. He's also an Army Reserve captain. Take it away, Jimmy.
Coop! What's cool. up, y'all? Hey, welcome to the shop, everybody. How we doing?
Hey.
What's going on?
All right, well, let's get it started. You know, if you've ever thought better of arguing with your neighbor, you know, about their lawn or their garbage or their dog. Well, you know, because you don't know necessarily they're packing heat. Well, a local newspaper in White Plains, New York, is helping people out. The Journal News posted an online database of handgun permit owners in the area, including their names and addresses, Michelle.
And as you might imagine, that upset a lot of people. And in retaliation, a blogger named Christopher Fountain posted the names and addresses of the newspaper staff. And Christopher Fountain talked to CNN yesterday about why he did it. This is what he had to say.
Frankly, I'm not a big fan of the media, and I felt that they were using this to harass gun owners, solely to harass gun owners, so I harassed them back.
Wow.
Don't you love people who don't like stereotyping, so they proceed to stereotype other people? Right.
Wait, the media talk to CNN.
Yeah. To his point, Michelle, turnabout is certainly fair play. When I saw the story, I didn't see the bigger news value of publishing something like this. This is sensationalism to cause a panic. I don't agree with any of it, frankly. But like I said, turnabout is fair play. Pablo Torre, you're a New Yorker. How do you feel about knowing where? Well, at least you know where some of the handguns are in your area. How do you feel about it?
So I didn't have a problem in principle with what they did. I mean, we should recognize that this was all public information. They didn't dredge up private anything. This was all publicly available. I think my quibble with it would have been maybe don't put the addresses specifically in there. Maybe have a map of some kind where it's at least somewhat more vague. I think the names, though, are totally fair. I mean, I think the reason why a guy like that who talked to CNN and so a lot of the other outrage that's been out there is because people feel like they're stigmatizing and targeting gun owners. And my whole thing is we should probably be at a point where we're giving the strictest scrutiny to gun owners. I don't think that a gun owner would be so put off by this if there wasn't a larger conversation about guns. And I think that is what this is really tapping into, which is a gun owner should be held up to the brightest of spotlights, to be perfectly honest, at this point.
That's interesting. Coop? Captain Coop,
this is where Fountain's excuse doesn't hold water is, in fact, those gun owners in New York have stood up to high scrutiny to be able to have a permit and legally obtain and own a firearm. They are not the criminals. In fact, most illegal gun ownership is because they are stolen. And so now what we have is a roadmap or a shopping list for where weapons can be stolen. Also, it's a roadmap or shopping list for a path of least resistance. We know from crime statistics that criminals will go where it's easier to commit a crime. So on one hand, they know where maybe not to face down the barrel. They also know where they can find arms if they want to steal them.
Well, the other point that I think, you know, one might make is that what if there's an undercover officer? A police officer. What if there's a sworn police officer who has a gun but who's working undercover? What if you have an order of protection? You are a domestic violence survivor and you have an order of protection and you're using that weapon to protect your family. I mean, there are lots of circumstances that people might use. But, you know, Arsalan, you know, this is an issue, isn't it, where the First Amendment meets the Second?
It does.
Right?
I think, you know, I do agree with Jimmy. I think it's a bad look on both sides. I think it was a bad look on the part of the newspaper to publish these hundreds and thousands of names. And I obviously think that it was a bad look for Mr. Fountain to, you know, publish the names and addresses of the newspaper employees. You know, when we look at, you know, names and addresses, you know, within the public domain, you know, I think many of us think of, you know, sex offenders and people who have committed an act of, you know, criminality, and I think that this does place a slight stigma on those people who were listed, because we do have that notion in our American zeitgeist that, you know, anybody whose name and address is put out in the public domain has done something wrong, and as Clark mentioned, these people have not done anything wrong. On the other side of it, I do think that Mr. Fountain was very wrong also in publishing the names and addresses of the newspaper staff, because, you know, that could put them in harm's way also, from, you know, disgruntled people. And I just think that this was a bad look all around.
Is there any way to put that genie back in the bottle?
No.
Well, I guess my point is, though, but wouldn't we want to know where gun owners are? I mean, there's a reason why they're publicly registered, right? I mean, it's a matter of access to that information.
I hear you, Pablo, but the problem is that we currently already have 300 million guns in circulation in the United States today, one for every man, woman, and child in this country. And so, you know, if we, you know, our entire map would be filled with little pinholes if we did that.
But the other is, I mean, there is an interesting question here about the First Amendment, the Second, and the whole question of privacy, which, you know, some conservatives argue is not in the Constitution, and some argue that it is. I mean, all of our tax return information is not readily available to the public. Mm-hmm. Our State Department files, our passport files are not readily available to the public. You know what I mean? It's an interesting question. I mean, I always interested in people say, well, I don't want the government to know X, Y, and Z. Well, the government already knows that. It's a question of
the public.
The public. I mean, it's kind of an ugly way to get to an interesting question, isn't it?
Yeah, I think just real
quick. Ugly and dangerous way. Again, let's remember is that these people are now on a list. So who knows who out there is a criminal or just an unhinged individual that may take advantage of this information. And again, going back to the path of least resistance, if there's a block there in Westchester where 6 out of 8 have guns in the household, and you're thinking about taking out a house, you're probably going to go to the 2 that may not have firearms.
Well, isn't that contrary to the NRA stated position that more guns equals more peace, in the sense that if you know that people have a gun in the house, then that is the area you're not going to go.
Well, Michelle, talking about the conceal and carry aspect. So states that have conceal and carry, again, it goes back to path of least resistance. So yeah, there is an aspect there, but again, what has happened now with this expose of this whole list, put it in, truly it's exposure. These people have lost any aspect of privacy. They've already gone through the means test with the government. They went through a very strict means test to get that permit and legally obtain these firearms.
Pablo?
I was just going to say, but the same logic of that argument would lead us to not make public any of that information ever, right? I mean, the idea is that the newspaper is just a conduit for this information. Yes, it makes it more accessible, but the idea that it's available, that we could always find out where these people live, would seem to agitate towards a policy that says we should not be able to ever find out who has a gun.
Well, it's an interesting question. Like, again, it's an ugly way to get to an interesting question. This is something that is going to have to be talked about now, isn't it? Kind of in the wake of this.
Definitely.
This debate over this.
This is not over. Yeah. When you have the NRA and the Brady Center having a corollary on this issue, it certainly has hit a point.
Well, again, though, it's a minor point, but I do have to point out that Christopher Fountain, the blogger, was reacting to what he felt was a way to demean and stigmatize gun owners. So what did he do? Is kind of demean and stigmatize reporters. I just found that, how do you –
reporters
that,
feel
who's
stigmatized
got the moral,
and demeaned
who's
on
got
a regular
moral
basis
high ground here?
And if you are neither one of them have the moral high ground.
If you're just joining us, we're having a weekly visit to the barbershop. It happens to be our last one of this year. We are joined by writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, sports writer Pablo Torre, and R. Clark Cooper. He is the executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans. That's a Republican group that advocates for the full inclusion of the LGBT community. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay, going from possible gun violence to cinematic gun violence. You know, I call Quentin Tarantino's flick Django Unchained in a private showing just before it broke this holiday.
And had to tell you it was at a private showing.
Brush your shoulders off.
I'm so sorry.
Brush your shoulders off.
To tell us you were too cool to go on Christmas. I'm sorry. What was the? But go ahead.
Poppy color.
Shout out to Reggie Hudlin.
Did you have artichoke appetizers? What was the word? Okay.
Like most Tarantino flicks, it's full of guns, blood, and blood. Michelle, we got a clip, yeah?
Yes, we do. It's from the trailer. I think it's is it scrubbed for language? No, it is
Yikes.
What it is. Here it is.
How'd you like the bounty hunting business?
You kill white folks and they pay you for it. It's not the light. I like the way you die, boy.
Well, let me summarize the plot. The movie takes place in the era before the Civil War. Jamie Foxx plays a former enslaved American called Django. The D is silent. He agrees to help a bounty hunter. In return, they are searching for Django's wife, who is under the, you know, ownership of Leonardo DiCaprio, who plays like a sadistic plantation owner. And part of the plot is that there's – that's kind of an oxymoron, or what's the right term here?
redundant.
Redundant. Yeah. So anyway, so Jimmy, what do you think? I mean, it's gotten all kinds of buzz.
I thought it was an interesting send up to an earlier film, Django, which stars Franco Nero, who actually makes a cameo in this film. Shout out to Franco. Bad, awesome film. This film, you know, it bookends Birth of a Nation. Finally, you know, after decades of white cop versus the ghetto movies, you know, we have that idea turned on its head. You know, this one film for every Steven Seagal, Dirty Harry, Charles Bronson, you know, white man versus the entire black community film. You know, finally, you know, we got somebody that's willing to brush their shoulders off, have some dignity, and take what is rightfully theirs, e.g., freedom and your wifey. Yo, Pablo, you saw it last night. What did you think, man?
I saw it with the masses, Jimmy. I saw it.
Did you really? The whole masses.
And you know, I mean, I saw it in downtown Brooklyn, and it was an amazingly fun experience. And I know I might sound hypocritical, given that I was just very strict on gun ownership and all of that. But I think this was a fantastic movie. And I think, I mean, we heard criticism earlier this month from Spike Lee, who was saying that, you know, I don't want to see it. My ancestry, slavery is not something to be sent up. It's not something to be parodied.
Yawn.
But, you know, I mean, Quentin Tarantino, and I think Spike actually used the term, it was a Holocaust, and we should always remember that Quentin Tarantino's last movie was Inglourious Basterds, which was kind of about that.
Exactly. Well, that's a good parallel there.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we come back. We'll hear from the other guys about this. I'm interested in what all of you have to say. We're having our weekly visit to the barbershop with Jimmy Israel, Pablo Torre, Arsalan Iftikhar, and R. Clark Cooper. Let's everybody stay with us as we take a short break. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Please stay with us. Michelle Martin, and you're listening to our weekly Barbershop Roundtable, the last of the year. We're joined by writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, sports writer Pablo Torre, and R. Clark Cooper, the executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans. Before we took a short break, Jimmy got all art house on us and told us how much he loved that Quentin Tarantino flick Django Unchained. It's getting a lot of buzz for all kinds of reasons. And before we took the break, Jimmy told us that he really liked it. Pablo also said he really liked it. We heard that Spike Lee, the famed movie director Spike Lee, said he will not see it because he thinks it's disrespectful. What about you two? R. Clark?
Well,
what's
again,
your deal?
I'm one of those purists. I'm a spoiler usually at historic period pieces. But like Inglourious Basterds, it does provide an opportunity for dialogue for people who maybe aren't normally attracted to history or understanding certain aspects of history. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about Django is the awkward relationship of freedmen and slaves. And that is an area in actual straight-up history as well as popular culture that's not normally addressed. Where I grew up, the number one contractor during the antebellum period was a freed man who actually purchased his wife. John Proctor built all these homes for these slave owners, yet he was a freed man himself, and he managed to negotiate that. And there's a tale there, kind of like Django, where he was separated from his wife, and she was put back into slavery. So there are some elements of truth there to the backstory. I think it's worth at least giving it a look-see. And if it gets somebody interested in history, great.
Arsalan, what about you?
Yeah, you know, the whole tie-in between Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained, I think, cannot be underscored enough. It's one of those things, you know, when Inglourious Basterds came out and, you know, people called it a Holocaust revenge movie, and this is sort of like a slavery revenge movie. You know, I think that's something, you know, talking about two very, very dark periods in modern human history, in a way that really hasn't been told from the history books or even cinema. And I think the major crossover is, of course, Christoph Waltz, who played, you know, the bad Nazi Mamma Jamma Hans Landa in Inglourious Basterds, is also prominently featured in Django Unchained.
I wonder, though, what the difference in reaction, because I don't remember there being this much anger and controversy around Inglourious Basterds. And I wonder whether in part because... Well, no, Jimmy, tell me, why do you think that is? Is it because there was already a Schindler's List? Because Schindler's List was kind of the definitive piece where people felt like the history was really honored and preserved so you could afford to take a more kind of over-the-top approach? Or
I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for this, but this may be the blackest film that is ever screened in mainstream American theaters. You know, this is everything that blackness, blackness is about. This is white fear of black empowerment by gun or otherwise. And at the end of the day, that's really how we define blackness. Black people define blackness by all kind of nuance. But at the end of the day, it's really about how white people feel about us. You know, whether they're afraid of us or not. And that those are the degrees by which we gauge blackness. And this has got to be the blackest film ever.
With all due respect, is the other black person in this conversation?
Sure.
I do not agree with that. I do not judge myself. Cool. I do not think of myself in that way in reaction to the gaze of others. I think of myself in terms of
the
history. I think of myself in terms of my history, my lineage, the journey to being here, the journey of survival. You know, all of I don't see myself in terms of someone else's gaze, but in terms of my own history and journey. That's what. But I take your point.
Federico Fellini
is real. Go ahead, Pablo.
Yeah, I think one interesting question is, sort of to Jimmy's point, is why haven't there been other movies about slavery like this? I mean, mentioned Schindler. Yeah,
but how many decades ago was Roots?
That was a black oppression story, clearly. This is a black empowerment story.
I'm kind of surprised, and I don't know if I'm the person to speak to this, but I'm just kind of surprised there hasn't been something that engaged with the subject matter in the same way that was as in the movie theater last night. It was incredibly cathartic. I mean, people really were having, number one, a lot of fun, but it clearly there was an element of catharsis there because there hasn't been a empowered character like this in that historical setting.
I think the catharsis is part of it because Amistad was that kind of respectful treatment. Glory was that kind of respectful treatment of that, you know, era. I don't know.
Well, and
you named two movies where all the empowered blacks were either maimed, killed, deported.
That's not true. Self-deported. They wanted to go. Excuse me.
When Sinke got back to Africa, he discovered his wife had gone and his children had been killed.
That's not part of the movie, Jimmy. I'm just letting you know. I'm just saying.
I'm just saying.
Go ahead, Arslan.
Very briefly, do you think the movie would have gotten as much critical acclaim if it was a black man who made the film?
A black man could not have made this film. Let's just say that out loud.
Why do you say that?
Once and for all time.
Why?
Because it's one of the blackest films that's ever been made. I mean, this is a really angry black narrative. You know,
because of the
black
revenge
director,
fantasy? You think the revenge fantasy would have been perceived
Spike
as too
Spike Lee could not have made this film.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Interesting, yeah.
Interesting. All right, well.
Maybe that's Spike Lee's issue is he wanted to make that film.
It could be.
Yeah, my aunt had that criticism.
I mean, he's not happy about it, but maybe he's
just salty. Right?
Yeah.
It was really good.
It could be. I mean, okay. Well, that's interesting. So it's like four thumbs up here, kind of. Four thumbs up and two tentative thumbs up or something like that. That's interesting. It's interesting. I don't know.
And you got to see it in the theater with other people.
You have to see it in
theater.
See
with the unwashed masses, Jimmy. You got to experience
see it twice.
This.
Yeah, I'm going back to see it, brother. You know
that's
right.
I don't think that gender's part of this either because I have women friends who thought it was off the chain and I have women friends who walked out because they thought it was just too much. So I don't think this is gender either. I think there's
I will say
your friends walk out because of violence.
It just was just more than they wanted to absorb into their heads. Anyway, before we let you go, this is our last visit before the new year. We talked about what we thought were the biggest news stories of the year, but I'm curious about what you thought was the most underreported story of the year. Can I hear from each of you, Clark? You want to start?
You're going to think that this has been overreported. The problem is that it hasn't. We've heard a lot of talk about the fiscal cliff. What we have not heard about are what the secondary and tertiary effects of what happens in the new year when things like the Bush tax cuts expire. What are those impacts? What are the impacts if the debt ceiling is not raised? And also, what are the impacts on if we're not addressing entitlement spending? And so there's a lot of cursory talk about it, but as far as how it impacts me, you, and the average American at the bottom line, that needs to be better spelled out. And I don't think people are ready for what is coming in the next 30, 60 days.
Arsalan?
Hands down, the most underreported story of the year is the civil war in Syria. You know, here we have a brutal dictator, Bashar al-Assad, who has, you know, violently cracked down on his people for over a year now. And, you know, in the aftermath of the Arab Spring in Tahrir Square in Cairo, it seems as though the global media has forgot about the suffering of the Syrian people. And so I think that's the most underreported story of the year.
Do you think that that's intention or inability to get to the story? I mean, people have been in and out. I mean, lots of major news organizations have been in and out. I mean, certainly NPR
right.
has been in and out.
And
CNN's been in and out.
There have been
effort not to go.
No, and there are journalists on the Turkish-Syrian border. I understand that. But I think that the strategic importance of Syria in the Middle East in terms of the global relations with Russia as Syria's really only remaining ally, I think, you know, hasn't been reported as much as it should have been.
Pablo, what about you?
Well, I'm going to take it from the sports context. We heard a lot about concussions this year. I think the brain, but in the terms of mental illness, is probably the most undercovered story. And we're sort of getting to that point now where people are really waking up to it. But for as much as we talk about CTE and head trauma and tau and the ways the brain can physically get damaged, I think it's always important to understand that there are some things that a fMRI, a brain scan, can never show, and that sports is oftentimes last to be aware and to be sensitive to those topics. And certainly with the rash of players taking their own lives, that's something that we're all going to be waking up to, hopefully sooner rather than later.
I want to concur on Pablo on that. The TBI is TBI. It doesn't matter if your head is in
TBI being?
Traumatic brain injury. Doesn't matter if you're wearing a football helmet or a Kevlar or an Army helmet on the field. That rattling around is the same impact. And so there does need to be some joint research and development on that from the mill side as well as the CIV side.
Hmm. Yep.
And Jimmy, what about you? What do you think?
I didn't
the most
hear enough about the persistent achievement gap in public school education. I would have liked to read and see more about reporting about speaking of achievement gap. My son is here reporting about
sounded like a lion in the background.
my honor roll student about
playing
about
his
how,
DS
how we. How we fix that gap in public school education and make our public schools somewhere we can send our children with pride.
Is there any story, Jimmy, that you think you heard more of than you would have liked to, that you think got more attention than it deserved?
The Gangnam Style. I'm sorry. Is that
just me? Come on, man.
Is that
Hater.
Just me?
I heard way too much
about that. When it finally broke, I was like, you know, it had broke for me months before it actually
over.
It's
it.
Just you.
1 billion YouTube hits. The most watched YouTube video in human history. That was not that. That was dope.
Whatever, man.
I'm sorry.
He's like those people that Taylor Swift writes songs about. If other people like it, it can't be any good. right? Clark, what do you think? What's your...
Kind of the same milieu there is this whole Call Me Maybe remakes. There's so many parodies of these things on YouTube, so we're going back to the whole YouTube thing. Enough. I mean, I don't need to see another cutesy Call Me Maybe remake by a group of guys out in the middle of Iraq or Afghanistan. So, yeah.
And get off our lawns.
Yeah.
Pablo, what about you?
I would say Twitter. We've made so much about Twitter this year, and I'm someone on it every hour. But it's important to remember that there are so many people in this country, in fact, an overwhelming majority, who have never been on Twitter, never will be on Twitter, and it's always good to recognize that there's more to life than my computer screen.
Okay, so you'll be turning the dial down in the next segment when we talk about the year in tweets, okay? You'll be getting a coffee then, right? Arsalan?
My most overreported story of 2012 was Mitt Romney, but then again, I only paid attention to about 47% of them.
Oh, ouch. Ouch.
Wow. Try the veal, tip your waitress.
All right, okay. I really am going to let you go this time, but I did want to ask, in keeping with our tradition, we have to hear your New Year's resolutions. We always get them from you, and mainly so we can embarrass you with them, you know, a year later. But who's got one? Arsalan, you got one?
My New Year's resolution is to try and limit myself to only 24 boxes of Girl Scout Thin Mint cookies.
What?
They're my heroine.
Clark?
I'm going to bring it in serious here. Actually, more time with family and friends. So my term at Log Cabin Republicans, and of course my time in the Bush administration, it's time for me to be able to focus on the family, so to speak. I need to, and I'm looking forward to that. So still going to be working hard, but been pretty much given the message by mom, stepdad, siblings, cousins, that I need to look at them sometime.
Well, we appreciate the time that you spend with us, but what about your reserve, your reserve service?
Oh, yeah, I mean, God and country. Yeah, that's still – I'm still doing that. I still love the Army. I'm still doing that. Met my commitment several years ago, but that's still something I'm going to be sticking to into the new year and beyond.
Pablo, what about you?
My resolution is to get more sunlight, partially because I may or may not be running a vitamin D deficiency due to the Twitter usage I just mentioned. but also because I don't get outside enough. I mean, I'm always engaged with my electronic devices, and somewhat along the lines of what Clark just said, I think getting more sunlight, getting unplugged once in a while is probably a good thing.
How are you going to do that? Do you have a plan?
I guess the first step, as they say, is opening the door and stepping outside, which is tough in the winter. I go outside sometimes and I'm like, oh, it's dark, and I've missed all of my opportunity to get that precious sunlight. So
that sounds really sad.
Sorry to depress all of you on the last note of the year.
All right,
no,
Pablo,
he's too busy
PT.
Studying the fiscal cliff. Jimmy, what about you? Resolutions?
I just want to be the best husband and father I can.
Aww.
That's it. That's my highest aspiration.
And what's
that's
your plan? Enough. What's your plan for putting that into place?
Take the garbage out occasionally.
That's a good start.
That's a step.
That's a good start. Well, it wouldn't be a New Year's program without predictions. So very briefly, what's your prediction for the biggest news story of 2013? Arsalan, am I putting you on the spot here?
No, I mean, I hope that in 2013 we hear of the official death of reality television once
not
and for all.
Not going to happen.
Amen. Yeah, that's
not going to happen.
Really?
A boy can dream, can he? Yeah.
Clark, what about you?
That books are still alive. I'm one of, you know, back to the grumpy old man on the lawn. I refuse to get a Kindle just yet. So bookstores still are well in doing business and are in the black beyond the next year.
Why do you hate? Why are you hating on?
It's e-readers? The whole tactileness. For whatever reason, I'm happy to get things like my news feed, be it Politico or Drudge Report or whatever, online. But I still, as far as when it's a book, I still want the actual book itself.
Okay. Prediction, Pablo.
I think it's going to have to do with the climate of planet Earth, to be perfectly frank. I mean, New York, we went through the storm, and, you know, I think at some point it's going to dawn on all of us that these things, and the fact that we had the hottest year on record ever this past year, I think all of those things are going to add up, and we may or may not be realizing that something is afoot on our little blue marble, and it's probably not good.
It's just full of cheer today.
Debbie Downer.
He's standing outside the corner proclaiming the apocalypse.
How would you know? You
later.
Never go outside. How
That's
would you know?
Say, you need some vitamin D.
It's Twitter. Yeah, Twitter is telling me that the apocalypse is coming.
Okay. Jimmy, final prediction from you.
We're going to get our hands in the dirt and fix our public schools. I mean, it's just atrocious. So I predict next year, you know, it's going to hit a tipping point, and we're finally going to see the need to address this in D.C., and that'd be the White House. I believe the big man is going to take this on.
You think school reform needs to start at the federal government, Jimmy?
Somebody's got to do something, man. I mean,
you going to start substituting, Jimmy?
I don't put me on the spot like okay, that. I mean, okay, you're not the first person to ask.
And what about the Browns? Okay, Pablo, if we don't get a Super Bowl prediction from you,
you know what?
It's not a good day. Go ahead.
I'm going to ride your boy RG3.
Stop
I think
it,
there's
really?
A certain magic here.
Washington,
there's
D.C.?
A certain magic here.
Oh, wow.
That if I'm right, this will pay off tremendously for me. And if I'm wrong, hopefully we'll all forget this. But I think RG3, people of Washington, D.C., you got a special one. And I think he's going to be very, very, very good when it matters the most. He is the best athlete at quarterback that I've ever seen.
Wow. Well, you've heard it from Pablo Arsalan. You know, do you want a piece of that?
Well,
Super
I mean,
Bowl prediction?
Still crying about your Celtics, Arsalan, aren't you?
Hey, I am. And I think that, you know, this NBA finals season is going to be quite interesting. You know, you have the upstart LA Clippers who are, you know, who've just won 15 in a row. You have the New York Knicks, Pablo's team, who, you know, still have only won one playoff game in the last 10 years. It's going to be really interesting to see if LeBron and company are going to be able to defend their title this year.
Clark, you got Super Bowl or NBA? Which?
Well, I'm going to start with Super Bowl, but I'm going to say they're not my team. I'm a university football guy, so Florida State's my team. But the Pats, I think, have a good chance. The New England Patriots have a good chance. And as far as hockey's concerned, no dice.
So, oh, that is so sad.
What's hockey? What's hockey?
What is it?
Jimmy,
yeah.
Jimmy, finally, Super Bowl.
For Columbus, Ohio.
Super Bowl prediction?
The Browns will not be in the Super Bowl.
Okay. Jimmy Israel is a writer and culture critic. He's also an adjunct professor of film and social media at Cuyahoga Community College. He was with us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Pablo Torre is a senior writer for ESPN.com, with us from our NPR studios in New York. R. Clark Cooper is a captain in the Army Reserve. He is the executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans, a group that advocates for gay and lesbian rights. And Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney and founder of TheMuslimGuy.com. Arsalan and Clark were with us in Washington, D.C. Thank you all so much, and Happy New Year to you all.
Peace. Oh,
Happy New Year.
Yep.